ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, really excited about the show this week. This is going to be a lot of fun. First, backed by popular demand, I'm going to wade back into this topic of ESG investing with ETF.com's Laura Krieger. I would say other than maybe non-transparent ETFs, nothing is dominating the ETF conversation right now like ESG is. And as I think everyone knows, Laura and I don't always see eye to eye on this topic, but she's simply fantastic at covering this space. So we're going to discuss several areas here. We're going to talk ESG ETF due diligence, so how you tell the difference between green and greenwash products. Laura's going to offer some tips on that. We'll also discuss how investors should think about ESG investing overall, because we know there's no one-size-fits-all approach. So Laura's going to explain how she likes to think about ESG, just in terms of doing what you can, but maybe not being perfect, and how that's okay. And then, of course, we will have a little ESG debate. For those of you skeptical of the space like I am, I'm going to see how Laura responds to a couple of my favorite ESG rebuttals. So I'll start there this week. I'll then be joined by Jason Wank, founder and CEO of Altruist. They're a startup digital custodian who's attempting to completely disrupt the custodial landscape. Of course, a custodian is simply where financial advisors hold their client accounts and where trades are conducted. Think Charles Schwab, TD Ameritrade, Fidelity. Altruist is offering those custodial services along with a whole suite of software and technology that advisors currently have to piecemeal together if they work with larger custodians. And the timing of this is perfect, because last week we saw the announcement that Morgan Stanley is buying E-Trade, who actually has an RIA custodian. Of course, we also have this pending deal between Charles Schwab and TD Ameritrade. Jason knows this entire space inside and out, so we're going to cover a lot of ground, including how brokerages and custodians currently make money and what the future might look like here. I'll then close this week with Tony DeFault, Managing Director of Pacific Global ETFs, who they fall under the Pacific Life umbrella, the insurance company who I think most people are familiar with. They launched their first ETFs last year. So we'll discuss why they did that and then take a look at those ETFs, which are all actively managed, by the way. Great show. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can go to etfprime.com. Let's chat with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
All right, Laura, let's start with the more serious stuff, and then you know I have to leave at least a little time for us to debate ESG. We've got to give the people what they want. So look, you hosted a webinar last week alongside ETF.com, Cynthia Murphy, where you covered the topic of ESG ETF due diligence, so how to best filter through the growing number of options out there. And one thing I know we both do agree on is there are a lot of quote-unquote greenwash products out there, right? ETFs that are marketed as ESG, but then when you pop open the hood, that's pretty much all they are, right? Just marketing. Mm-hmm. So for investors new to this space who are interested in taking an ESG approach to their portfolios, just walk through some of the basics, like where should they start and some of the initial things they should consider.
Right. So in the webinar that Cynthia and I did, we offered up three starting points for investors. And the first is to set your goals. So you really have to understand what you want out of investing in ESG. Are you trying to capture some outperformance from a thematic investment? Or are you trying to capture market beta just without any of the objectionable stocks that give you pause, right? So you have to settle that question first, alpha versus beta, before you can even really begin to dig into specific funds or greenwash versus green or ESG scores or any of that. So you have to know what you want. The second step is to define some ground rules, right? So what sort of due diligence metrics do you have to satisfy? Do you have size, liquidity, cost, performance constraints? Do you have, you know, what sort of tax burden can you shoulder? That sort of thing. And then on top of that, you also have to decide if there are certain stocks or certain sectors that you or your clients just simply cannot touch or won't touch ever. You know, religious objections or ethical objections or environmental objections. You have to go through that list too. And then the third step is to figure out if you have any sort of positive targets that you would like to meet, right? So is there a certain overall target ESG score that you're looking for example, or a certain threshold carbon intensity or carbon footprint, a positive impact score, that sort of thing. Once you set these first three, you know, once you do these first three steps, only then should you really start looking into which funds are going to make sense for you, for your clients, because, and you can't skip them, right? You can't skip these steps, because if you do, you could end up frustrated and confused as to why ETF A's performance and portfolio doesn't match up to your expectations. And you know, you mentioned green versus greenwashing, and I think that's fair. There is a lot of greenwashing in this space, but at the same time, I think some ESG ETFs get maybe unfairly accused of being greenwashed because the investor's perception is that it should behave one way, but that perception's a little bit off base, right? So, you know, in the webinar, I broke out ETFs that fall into this category into two subcategories. There's the best of the best ETFs, which are alpha seeking thematic funds, you know, your vegan ETFs, your solar energy ETFs, that sort of thing. And then there are the best of the rest ETFs, which are broad market ETFs that screen out those worst ESG scoring stocks and then market weight, you know, market cap weight the rest. So investors who are new to, you know, to green ETFs often confuse these two categories of ETFs, assuming that the market beta funds are going to act just like the alpha seekers and vice versa. And so maybe they might get upset when they see Exxon in a portfolio for an ESG ETF, you know, or maybe they're frustrated that the returns aren't higher and they say, well, this is a greenwashed ETF and so on and so forth. So you really have to go back. I think you have to start with that first step of trying to decide what you want out of this ESG investment. And knowing that is going to save you so much heartburn in the long run.
No, I think you raised a lot of really excellent points there. You know, you mentioned the broad market ESG ETFs. I feel like overall, that's where a lot of the attention is being focused right now. And you mentioned something like Exxon being held in those ETFs. Regarding the underlying data that powers these broad market ESG ETFs, I know there's a lot of subjectivity here, right? There are a lot of different ways to measure ESG. The question I have for you is, realistically, how are investors supposed to evaluate the different scoring processes here? Because that just seems like a heavy lift to me. And I know investors should always do their homework, right? I preach that. But it just seems like you could really go down a rabbit hole on this stuff. And I'm wondering, for the average investor who does want to take an ESG philosophy in the core of their portfolio, how much digging should they do on the underlying data powering these?
I absolutely agree that it's a great question. You know, you always have to do your homework, but there's a fine line between doing your homework and getting a PhD in the subject, right? Nobody wants to do a PhD in ESG scoring. So, and it's not always easy to understand what goes into an ESG score, right? Some data providers are more opaque than others. So in a broad sense, ESG scores are made by, you know, ESG providers calculate their scores across four metrics. There's the company's risk factors, their current business practices, their historical track record in dealing with climate risks or governance risks or so on, and exposure to controversies. So from whichever data provider you pick, whether it's MSCI, Sustainalytics, S&P, those are the four main vectors that they're going to be evaluating companies along. And then, they do it across the environmental, social, and governance lines, right? Now, whether you want to get into every, 500 pieces of data points, whether you want to dig into every single one of those, I don't think it's realistic for investors to investigate every single one. But it's not necessarily a bad thing to do it for maybe a couple of, test cases, right? Maybe some high conviction stocks or high conviction ETFs. If you have a strong feeling about, say, Exxon, right? We're picking on Exxon today. Let's go with Exxon. If you have a strong feeling about Exxon, you can go look up Exxon's ESG score on, say, MSCI's ESG website. You can just look it up by ticker or company name and see what the score is and what the broad strokes of why that company was scored the way it was. You can do that with ETFs as well. And I'm only picking out MSCI here because it's the one that I'm most familiar with, it being the one that we use on our website. But, I think you can do the same with some other providers as well to some extent. And if you can't, you can always just pick up the phone and call them, right? So, it's not a bad thing to take maybe a case study or two and understand how the rules apply to this particular stock or ETF, and then, see if that lines up with what you want, right?
Well, I think a perfect case study and one that you pointed out is if you see fossil fuel free, because that could mean fossil fuel reserves free, right? So that excludes companies with reserves of oil, gas, coal. But that could include service providers like pipeline companies or significant customers of fossil fuels. I think that's a good example.
That's an excellent example. And it's why you should always be careful to read beyond the name on the label. Because up till a certain point, some of these fossil fuel reserves-free ETFs were being marketed as fossil fuel-free. And they aren't. They really aren't. Now, that has changed, right? In the last couple of years, the marketing around those funds has shifted. But, examples like that are still out there for sure. You have to be careful.
Well, and by the way, I do want to mention on next week's podcast, I'll actually be joined by the CEO of Confluence Analytics, Connor Platt. So they offer research tools that help look at ESG ratings and how they impact the returns of both stocks and ETFs. And the idea here is to really help better analyze ESG data overall. So I did want to mention that. Laura, before we get to the debate portion of our conversation, which I know you're really excited about, look, we all know ESG investing can be highly personal. And as I mentioned earlier, we know ESG ETFs aren't one size fits all. So how should an investor think about I guess that as they incorporate ESG? In other words, if an investor really does believe ESG can make a difference, or maybe it just makes them feel good, and knowing that ESG ETFs are no panacea, what should the expectations be? Or how do you like to think about this?
I think that ESG investing is an incredibly individual process, right? It means different things to it means different things to different people, and that's often highlighted as a bug, but sometimes it can be a feature of the process, right? What I consider ESG is different than what you might consider ESG. I might care a lot more about human trafficking, and you might care a lot more about solar energy, but that doesn't mean that we're not, ESG investing, both of us. So I think you can, how should investors approach the ESG space? You really have to go back to that first starting step, which is, what are you trying to get out of this? Once you know that, once you know whether you're looking for market beta exposure, but human trafficking really, really bothers you, and you'd like to have your investments have a certain carbon footprint, you can start to tailor your investments accordingly. But you can't just stop at ESG is on the label and there my homework is done, right? You've got to do that soul searching to figure out why you really want to be involved in this.
For an investor though, who is again, using broad-based ESG ETFs, because I still think those are getting the most attention right now. The example I always use, what if there's a company that scores really high on the environment, but really low on, let's just say, labor issues or diversity in the workplace? How should an investor reconcile that? Because chances are an ESG investor is going to want a company to score high on both of those metrics. And so I'm just trying to get around the mindset, like how do you reconcile a company who may be doing really well in one area and not the other, and you're owning those companies in your portfolio?
That's a really good point, right? And some will be scoring really well on the environmental and social side of things, but their governance is just through the toilet. So, you know, it's again, I mean, I feel like a broken record. I'm sorry about it, but it is an individual process. Some people are going to care more that a company scores poorly on social metrics than other people will. Some people will say, okay, you know what? They're doing fine on environmental side of things. So I'm okay with that. That's all I care about is that, you know, they're high environmental scores, and they will be fine investing that way. So it's really about knowing yourself and what your tolerances are. And understanding, I guess, you know, how scores are made too, how the sausage is made, right? So what factors are going into these scores and so on and so forth. So,
no, well, it gets back into the ETF due diligence aspect, right? And it's really not buyer beware. It's like you have to dig in and do your homework and understand what it is you're getting. Laura, we only have a few minutes left. I do want to throw out a couple of my favorite ESG rebuttals to you. I know we probably covered these before, at least to some degree, but honestly, on this first one, I'm still waiting for someone to change my mind. I'm not saying you're going to do that today, but I'm still pretty dug in on this. So I keep saying, I know you've seen this, that I think the financial markets, not ESG committees, not ESG data providers, whoever, it's the financial markets who decide which companies are, quote unquote, doing the right things according to society standards. And my point being that you don't even need ESG ETFs. The financial markets are a natural ESG screener. Every ETF already has a built-in ESG overlay. And the way I like to frame this is, let's say society in aggregate doesn't like Facebook's data privacy issues. Well, guess what? People will stop using Facebook, and Facebook's profits will go down. Facebook's market cap will shrink, and they'll naturally have a smaller weighting than any ETF. What is wrong with my logic here?
I think there's nothing, there's nothing necessarily wrong with your logic. It's that the effectiveness, I think you're overstating. So ultimately, I feel like the markets can only really ever be a lagging indicator of the ESG-ness of a stock. And that lag may sometimes be significant because there are so many other factors that go into the pricing of a stock beyond just public sentiment about, you know, it's privacy issues in the case of Facebook. If the markets are a natural ESG screener, they're kind of a weak one because they have so many different inputs going in compared to the systems and the metrics that are custom built to inform investors about the ESG-ness of a stock.
But my pushback on that would be, don't you think the best active investors out there, there are some very talented active managers, whether it be mutual funds, hedge funds, individual stock selectors, they are all looking at every risk and opportunity of every one of the companies they invest in. And ultimately, those active investors are setting stock prices. And so, you know, do you think they're simply ignoring ESG risks when evaluating companies? My question would be, you know, why would they do that? And certainly they're paying attention to something like Facebook's data privacy issues. They're aware of that. And so I just feel like that's baked into the price.
But it's also not the only thing they're considering, right? They're considering a whole host of things versus an ESG screening mechanism. The only thing that they're looking at are these particular criteria. They're not, you know, stepping outside of that realm. And so if that's something that, you know, if it's a more targeted approach, I guess, is what I want to say. And it's cutting through the noise to get to the signal, so to speak. You're not wrong. You're not wrong that the markets have sort of baked into them, this prioritization of ESG characteristics that really matter, you know, but there's so much going on that it has to be a really, really big thing, a really, you know, very, very huge scandal or a huge controversy. That's the other thing. Most of the time, the things that are getting, you know, pinged by active managers or by the markets are almost entirely negative controversies, right? They're not prioritizing the positive things that a company might be doing, or doing it right. Because you know, negative press is what we concentrate on in the markets. I mean, people don't get as excited about a company doing something right as they do about a company doing something way wrong, you know? So
I just feel like, I hear what you're saying, but I just feel like an active investor, and again, there are a lot of talented active managers out there, they're going to be looking at both sides of the equation. Why would they ignore the opportunities? Why would they ignore the good things that a company might be able to do, which ultimately could help them either increase their bottom line or sort of raise their profile socially or politically or whatever the case may be, that's going to help the company. And I just don't know why any good active manager wouldn't be paying attention to all risks. I you know, why would they just exclude ESG? But okay, we only have a couple of minutes left. Let me throw one more at you. So I don't know if you saw this. Bloomberg had a graphic a couple of weeks ago where they showed the top five companies in the S&P 100 with the lowest ESG scores. The scores were from Sustainalytics, I believe. So the companies were Netflix, Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon, Costco, and Boeing. And of course, Berkshire owns a bunch of different companies, right? Duracell, Fruit of the Loom, Geico, Dairy Queen, Kraft Heinz. We go on down the list. The question I have for you is, to be consistent, should an investor who believes they're making a difference by excluding these companies in their ESG ETFs also stop using these companies as a consumer? I'll give you the last word here.
Sure. I don't think the argument you are against unethical business practices, but also you exist in a capitalist society is as compelling as it might seem on the surface. You picked out Amazon. Let's take Amazon. So if there were some alternative out there to using Amazon, that would be one thing. But increasingly for consumers, there isn't, at least not in a meaningful way, right? So you could go buy bed sheets on Amazon. You can buy them from Target. But you can't go down to local mom and pop bed sheet store anymore because it doesn't exist. You can't get a reasonable price on bed sheets at this mom and pop store. It doesn't exist. You have little choice but to support a company that has a less than stellar track record on labor rights and a non-environmentally friendly supply chain and so on. It's not like you can sleep on a bed without sheets either, right? So increasingly our industries and our sectors are distilling into highly concentrated slices of just a handful of companies. If you're lucky, sometimes it's a monopoly or a duopoly if you're not. So saying that you refuse to invest in Amazon, but also you happen to shop at Amazon, it's kind of a non-starter because as much as we like to cling to the concept of the power of the consumer, consumers have limited power of choice nowadays. And that's at least compared to investors who have unlimited choice and who aren't forced to invest in anything that they don't want to.
I feel like if you're really... you have high conviction around something that you can find the alternative. I know bed sheets, that's just an example you're throwing out there. Obviously, there are plenty of places to go buy bed sheets. But if you really believe in your cause, I feel like you should be going the extra mile to avoid certain businesses or support those businesses, because that's what you're doing in your investment portfolio if you're investing in ESG, let's say ESG ETFs. So if you're going to go the extra mile there, why not go the extra mile as a consumer? But Laura, we're going to have to leave it.
I don't disagree.
Always so much fun. You know, I absolutely love debating this topic with you. I really appreciate your perspective. Perhaps someday you are going to change my mind. I'm leaving that option open. I guess we'll have to see. But thank you for joining me this week.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. My next guest is Jason Wenk, founder and CEO of Altruis. They're a startup digital custodian that's hoping to completely disrupt the traditional custodian landscape. And Jason has a very interesting background. He's already started two highly successful investment firms, Retirement Wealth Advisors and Formula Folios. Along with that, he was named an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year in 2018. And Jason is now on the line with me from Venice Beach, California. Jason, really excited to connect. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks so much, and appreciate the great music to kick off your show.
I appreciate that. So look, you are building what's being called the first ever fully integrated brokerage platform for financial advisors, and I certainly want to get into all the details of that. I also want to talk about the current custodian landscape, because we obviously had some big news last week with Morgan Stanley and E-Trade. But let's start by taking a step back and discussing how you got to this point. So tell us a little bit about Retirement Wealth Advisors, Formula Folios, and then how you ultimately came to found Altruist.
Sure, happy to. I think, you know, the irony here is, you know, I started my first RIA firm in 2004, and I remember the first thing you typically do when you start an advisory firm is you reach out to a custodian, you know, a place to hold your client assets, do trades, things like that. And in that process, you know, 15 plus years ago, I remember talking to, you know, at the time the players were kind of the same as they are today. Names were slightly different. You know, TD Ameritrade was TD Waterhouse, but you know, you had Schwab and Fidelity. And in those early conversations, I remember you talking to the sales reps and then kind of saying, okay, well, you know, here's a link to our, you know, partner store or something to that effect. You know, and essentially, these are all the vendors that you'll need, you know, to launch a successful advisory firm. And I remember, like, my, you know, kind of digging in, and then my question back was like, well, why isn't this stuff included? You know, it seemed kind of odd to me that I had to have, you know, a separate package of software to handle trading, something else for fee billing, for performance reporting. I thought it was like the craziest thing ever that you couldn't get accurate performance reportings directly from the source. You had to go pay some third-party vendor to unpack all of the transactions and give you meaningful, you know, performance history for clients. So I think that, you know, those early conversations essentially shaped, you know, the formation of Altruist. Yeah, I went on to build a couple different multi-billion-dollar RAs, so I made the old technology work. But it was never easy, and the bigger the firms got, the more I realized that, and kind of longer time went by, that the methods weren't changing. You know, no one was taking anything and they're really digitizing it. Instead of things getting simpler, they're getting more complex. And really, the parties that lose in this were both advisors and their clients. So all the complexity and cost, you know, makes it harder for an advisor to run a business. And typically, it also means they have to continually raise their minimums. So, you know, we've seen financial advice, at least, you know, personalized financial advice become less accessible. So, you know, unless you have a lot of money or a lot of income or willing to pay a lot of money in fees, it's been almost more challenging to get access. So that's kind of the impetus, right? Was a long journey. I think finally in 2018, I thought, you know, if no one else is going to do this, there's so many conflicts of interest, so many reasons that we needed improvement that I decided to tackle it myself.
Okay, so with that as a background, explain exactly what Altruist does and sort of what you view as the overall primary value proposition here.
Sure. Yeah, so like the most simple way to think of it is, you know, all of the key software that's needed to run an advisory firm is built directly into our custodial platform. So there's, you know, not much need to pay for expensive third-party software. And then even the custodial platform itself, we thought, you know, let's take a look at what we didn't like about the existing options and then really architect the solution to fix those issues. So it's interesting today, you know, most of the major independent RA custodians are offering commission-free trades. We were actually the first one to do it. And similarly, there's others talking about offering fractional shares, but of the major custodians, none of them are to market yet. We're already doing that. Digitally opening accounts might sound silly, but you know, one of the biggest burdens for many advisors is how difficult it is to open accounts for clients and then fund the accounts, you know, transfer securities. Our platform makes all of those you know, sort of nuanced administrative tasks incredibly simple and really fast. You know, 500, you know, percent more efficient than really any other custodial solution. So it makes it really easy for advisors to essentially do better work for clients and serve more people, The ultimate goal is to make financial advice better, you know, cheaper and more accessible.
And what does the fee structure currently look like?
Yeah, so the advisor pays a fee only after they exceed 100 accounts. So it's 100 free accounts for all RIA firms. Once they exceed 100 accounts, it's $1 per account per month. So you can imagine, right, some very basic math. If someone had 300 client accounts, it would cost the advisory firm $200 a month. There's no commissions, no revenue share. So a lot of the things, the little ways that a brokerage firm would make money or consumer make money, we still do make money in some of those areas, but it's a substantially lower amount. And then, again, by sort of packing the software services in, our software tends to be 90, 95% cheaper than if someone bought that sort of standalone and merged it with their custodian.
Jason, if I just take a step back here, look, the space you're attempting to disrupt obviously has several very established players, dominant players. And it's not like those firms are standing still, right? As I mentioned earlier, we saw the news last week with Morgan Stanley looking to purchase E-Trade, who has an RIA custodian. We have the Schwab TD Ameritrade deal pending. And even beyond that, to your point, we've seen everyone go to commission-free trading. Fidelity did recently offer fractional shares trading. I think Schwab is expected to follow. How do you view the current competitive landscape and sort of your ability to make inroads here?
Yeah, I think so a lot of the services, right, even things like fractional shares, are still haven't made it to RIA firms yet. So they're early on the consumer side, so going directly to the end client. But but not so much offering these services to RIA firms. And we'll see what Morgan Stanley does with E-Trade. I mean, I think there's still a ton of questions about what did they do with that RIA custody unit. There was a lot of changes that were already set to happen because the RIA custody unit was technically an acquisition by E-Trade, you know, a couple of years ago. And so there's a lot that I think that still needs to be done. And I think in terms of, like, you know, why Altruist and why now, you know, I think the simple analogy is, you know, it's difficult to swap out engines in a plane when it's mid-flight. These incumbents have very, very old technology. And even if their technology is only, let's say, you know, 5 to 7 years old, that's still very difficult and to be highly relevant today. The direction that most technology has gone is into a very cloud-native microservices architecture. Probably means nothing to most people as they hear it, but essentially it's much more flexible. It's very easy to sort of change out small parts of your platform, so you can always have a really modern experience. Most of the technology we see custodians using today is mainframe software, you know, built anywhere from 25 to 50 years ago, and very minimally changed since then. They'll build some new, you know, sort of web-based services, but those services are essentially calling on, hardware, you know, that's not actually in the cloud, and in many cases, not particularly flexible. So I think, like, our biggest competitive advantage is the fact that we are new. I would hate to be, and I talk with a lot of the technology leaders at major custodians, and a lot of them envy the fact that we're able to build with today's resources versus having to retrofit something that's, you know, multiple decades old.
Jason, when I think about the business models of brokerages and custodians, to me, one of the single biggest areas to watch is net interest, right? The money brokerages make off of cash sweeps. And just so everyone's on the same page, if you leave cash sitting in your investment accounts, let's say at Schwab, you basically get paid peanuts on that money. And then Schwab is investing or lending out that cash at a significantly higher yield and, of course, pocketing the difference. I guess first, how is Altruist handling cash sweeps?
Yeah, so there's two really big advantages we have on default cash sweeps. I think the first one is trading fractional shares. So, you know, obviously with ETFs, one of the big differences between them and mutual funds, among a bunch of other differences, right, don't need to educate you, and probably a lot of your listeners already know this, but is that traditionally they sell in whole shares, just like individual equities. So depending on someone's account size, it's not uncommon if you're trying to build an all equity or all ETF portfolio to hold excess cash. With mutual funds, although they have a slew of issues in many cases, they can be bought with fractional shares. So in theory, you can hold virtually no cash in those accounts. So the whole idea with sort of net interest is less of an issue. We've just made everything fractional shares, and to the extent where, you know, a client could hold almost nothing in cash, and because we also have no transaction fees, even if they have cash flows, like monthly money coming in or monthly money going out, they never have to actually hold money in cash. So that's one of the huge advantages. The second is we'll offer a yield that's about five times higher than the default sweep. It still won't be amazing on day one, but we're working pretty hard actually on a sort of a secondary cash account, hoping to launch maybe Q3 or Q4. That should pay, like, in today's rates, you know, early 2020 rates, the equivalent of about 1.6%. So we expect to be much more competitive even day one, and then kind of build on that throughout the year. But I think one of the bigger takeaways is that, you know, if your objective is to be a long-term investor, you probably shouldn't be holding a lot of cash in your investment accounts. You should have your cash in cash accounts for different purposes. And we're trying to make that really, really easy and a lot more efficient.
Well, and one of the reasons I headed down this path is because I think one of the biggest stories last year with the major brokerages going to commission-free trading is that it really put the spotlight on the different ways brokerages and custodians are making money. And of course, some of these, I think a Schwab and Fidelity, they also offer funds, right? So you see zero fee funds out there, and the end investor is going, wait a minute, if my trades are free, my funds are free, how are these businesses making money? And then that obviously led to net interest and the yields on cash sweeps. I think if you look at somebody like Charles Schwab, what, 60% of their revenue, something like that, comes from net interest. How do you feel just about the overall transparency of these business models? Because you also have things like selling order flow, their securities lending. I'm assuming you may do some of those things as well. I mean, do you see those as issues where you have customers maybe getting something that looks like a low cost or free service, but they're paying for it on the back end and may not fully understand that?
Yeah, so I think the transparency discussion is way overdue. You know, we were probably one of the first people to write about it. I remember when I was trying to, you know, sort of stand on my soapbox and tell this story years ago, and people were kind of like, you know, turning the other way. They didn't want to hear the message. But I, you know, my common, you know, comments would be, look, commissions are just, you know, sort of pulling the fleece over your eyes. It's to make you believe that's what you're paying, when in fact it's sort of inconsequential, you know, to most brokerage businesses, custodian businesses. So I'm really glad to see that they went away. So now people are actually asking these questions and starting to better understand, you know, where the money's actually made. And you're totally right. You know, Schwab, as an example, it's, again, roughly 60% of revenue, and almost all of their profitability is coming from credit interest. The second most, you know, revenue that's made from most custodians is revenue share. You know, so essentially the money they get paid from product companies to sell their products. So they make more money on rev share from third parties than they do from actually selling their own proprietary products, you know, like their own branded ETFs or mutual funds and so forth. So it's really an interesting landscape. I'd say that while there are, you know, there are things that people talk a lot about, I'll tell just from experience, that, you know, payment for order flow doesn't pay a whole lot. You know, it's much less than commission revenue, for what it's worth. You know, so I think if people are thinking, oh, that's, you're going to get really bad fills, and that's because the, you know, custodians we make a ton of money, not entirely true. There are best execution policies that all broker dealers have to honor, and if they don't, they get fined. And so I'm not saying that that's perfect, but, you know, there are at least some rules there. And in essence, you know, it's sort of that's probably one of the bigger responsibilities advisors will have down the road, is to make sure that they're working with a custodian that really gets their clients best execution. The only way to really do that then is the custodians and broker dealers have to be transparent about things like, where do they make their money, how much are they making, and also how good are they at getting best execution. Unless everybody's transparent about how they're running and operating their businesses, instead of having, again, a transparent commission that is really not that transparent, what we're going to have is just a lot of very confused, you know, people wondering where the best spot is for, you know, holding their accounts and placing their trades. So I can only really speak to us. I can't speak to what other companies will do, but our intention is just to be fully transparent. You know, we see no reason why not to publish something akin to a quarterly report, even though we're a private company, that just explains, you know, here's our execution and here's how we make our money. I don't think it should be a mystery to people what's happening with their accounts. And I think if you're doing it right, you should be proud enough to tell people about it.
I guess on that note, any thoughts about a percentage of assets custodial fee or some other type of custodial fee model? And I just want to be clear, and I've said this before, look, of course custodians should be paid fairly, right? You're providing an extremely valuable service. But the question would be, why not just charge a custodial fee and avoid making money on, again, what some may say are less than transparent methods like whatever, cash sweeps or payment for order flow or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be difficult in a lot of respects. I mean, to have that be done very honestly, I think that's the biggest challenge. And I don't mean to like laugh when saying it, but what I mean is, if a custodian completely got rid of, and they just said, look, the only way we're going to make money is by charging a percentage fee for access to our platform. Everything else will be wholesale, exactly at the prices that we get it for. No upcharges, no hidden anything. What you'd find is that they'd start charging you probably around 25 to 30 basis points because that's what they make today. In fact, in many cases, they make more than that, 45 basis points, you know, so almost a half a percent per year. And so if they needed to reach parity, they would just have to charge these really high fees. Now, imagine if you're an advisor and you're going to your client and saying, hey, you know, so my fee is this, but, you know, my custodian charges this. And, oh, by the way, we use these products and these, you know, all of a sudden you haven't really made anything more simple. You know, yes, you would be able to tell someone precisely the cost of doing business, but it would be a very high number. And again, unless everybody honored that, you'd end up having a more complicated world than we live in today. So I think it'd be really, really tough. I'm not opposed to it. I just think that it's perhaps not likely to get the outcome people would like. Instead, what I think will happen is you're going to totally see some RIA custodians start charging a percentage, but guess what? They're going to keep charging you the other stuff too. You know, and so you're
depending.
You know, you're going to have more expenses without any enhanced transparency. And again, unless everybody's doing it, it's just going to create more confusion in the marketplace, which is really bad, you know, for everybody.
All right. Another area I did want to ask you about, and this is something that I don't think it's talked about nearly enough. The fact that larger custodians are competing directly against the advisors on their platforms, right? Because they all offer financial advisory services and robo-advisors. How do you think that plays out longer term? Because it seems like the bigger these custodians get and the more scale they gain in other areas of their businesses, I would think this becomes more of a problem for financial advisors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think so there's kind of three things I would cover on this. I'll try to cover them quick. So I'd say the first is that, you know, these custodians are running, you know, 100-year-plus businesses. And just sort of categorically, I'm just saying they have no intention of ever going away. They plan on being around forever. So they can play a very macro game. And really what they're doing is they're looking into the future and they're saying, well, what does financial advice look like in 20 years? Many financial advisors fail to do this. And what I mean by that is in 20 years, you know, your clients are going to be people who today are 10 years old, 15 years old, you know, 20 years old. Those people are going to have very, very different expectations in terms of how they handle their money, how they get help. And just a great example for anyone who has a teenager, I have two of them, they don't even like talking on the phone. Like they would rather just text you, you know, or message you via an app. Like they have no interest in sort of the personal relationships, at least at this stage so far. We've seen nothing from sort of that Gen Z that suggests that they want to go talk to a human financial advisor. So, you know, if you're a custodian, the first thing you're doing by, you know, looking at sort of all of these direct-to-consumer ways of doing business is you're preparing yourself for a future that is very different than the way financial advice is delivered today. So that's kind of item one. I think item two is that's also, if you look at, again, the public companies that offer advisory, you know, direct-to-consumer, robo or otherwise type services, that's one of their other biggest money makers. That's really great business, right? Because they're actually making all the brokerage revenue that they make from a regular custodial account. They get to control what percentage goes in cash, and typically it's an inflated number that's unnecessary and not beneficial to a consumer, but it really helps the broker-dealer or, you know, the brokerage element of a custodian. And then they get to use their own proprietary products a lot. So they get to make money everywhere. It's like the most lucrative business they could be in, even if they charge you nothing for it, right? So think about like Schwab's, you know, intelligent portfolios where they can charge you nothing for access and yet they make more money off that than any other line of business they do. So of course they're going to do that. And then the last part, you know, so my third point, which I think is really fascinating is, you know, many big advisory firms got big on the back of referrals from their custodians. So there's this interesting world. So why don't people talk a lot about it? Well, most of the biggest customers of a custodian, at least on the RIA side, they got that way because their custodian referred them to business. But that's really starting to change a lot. In fact, it's already been changing a lot, meaning it's very hard for any new firms to get those referral agreements, almost impossible. So you have a small group of very large, you know, old RIA firms receiving the benefit of custodian referrals. Meanwhile, again, the landscape of financial advisors is changing. You know, it's today, I think the average age is late 50s or something to that effect. So again, what does that look like in 20 years? So advisors are sort of thinking micro, right? They're thinking very short time frames, less than 10 years, in many cases, less than 1 year out in advance. The custodians are playing this long game. I think if advisors don't wise up, they're going to find themselves really pinched, you know, because it doesn't take a lot of like rocket science type math to forecast that in 10 plus years, you know, let's say right around the 10-year mark, we'll probably see over $1 trillion in these robo-based, you know, sort of platforms, whether they're the ones run by custodians or product companies, a la Vanguard, Schwab, et cetera, or just the actual, you know, direct consumer platforms like, you know, Betterment or Wealthfront, et cetera. So while none of those things today probably scare advisors much, the truth is like they're going to be very, very big business units down the road and be well positioned to serve a next generation of clients. And so if I'm an RIA today, I'm not really psyched about that, which is, you know, again, I say all this, you know, obviously somewhat self-interest, you know, that we made a very clear decision to only work with RIA firms and their clients. I feel there's a tremendous amount of value having a personal financial advisor can provide, and I don't feel that everybody is going to be served well by just a computer. Certainly some will be, and many will be, actually, but there's always going to be a need for human financial advice, the unique things that we can do, and a lot of it's just the empathy that we can provide. And sort of the coaching to make sure people are making smart choices with their money. But there's really no one else who's really just zeroed in on serving that demographic. Instead, you've got a lot of these conflicts, not just in business model, but also, you know, sort of the competing with their customer element.
Jason, only about 2 minutes left. On that note, any concern about the disruptor being disrupted? So I think of someone like Robinhood, and look, they may still end up being highly successful, but they really pioneered commission-free trading and having a slick user interface. And of course, everyone has now copied them. And the people doing the copying, the Schwabs and Fidelity and everyone else, they have significantly more resources. Does that worry you at all that you clear a road for everyone and then they end up trying to run over you? Or to the points that you were just talking about, do you feel like it's just too hard for them to turn because of these, you know, this long established history of how their business models are built?
Yes, I think that's actually a great example of why I'm not particularly concerned. If we think about Robinhood, what's really interesting is that when Schwab and Fidelity and so forth all went to commission free, it's not like Robinhood account holders closed their accounts and moved them to Schwab. What Robinhood did really successfully is they attracted an entirely new clientele, right? So I'd say of their, I think they report having 10 million or so brokerage accounts nowadays. And let's just say that 8 million of those are from people who never had a brokerage account before. You know, so they got an entirely new group of investors interested in investing. And for what it's worth, if you go talk to a teenager, I have, again, a couple of them. So it's funny, if I ask like my 19-year-old son, he probably doesn't know who Charles Schwab is, but he knows exactly who Robinhood is. And that was their whole point. You know, they didn't want to appeal necessarily to a Schwab customer. They wanted to appeal to somebody entirely different. I think we have that same advantage. I don't think any of those larger companies, while they're trying to copy, they don't have slick user interfaces. Their user experience is miserable. You know, their design in many cases is difficult to look at. You know, it's different strokes for different folks, I guess, but they're definitely not appealing to the same audience. And I think we have that same general appeal. You know, there's a new generation of people giving financial advice that really care about clients. They're willing to charge fees differently, put client interests first. They expect a digitally native experience. They really, really care, and they want to align with a company that feels the same way and puts their money where their mouth is and a product that aligns with it. So we feel really, really good about our position in the marketplace, largely because we're not actually trying to compete with Schwab, you know, or Fidelity. They have their place in the market. We think we'll have ours, similar to how Robinhood coexisted very nicely, in fact, has succeeded really well since everyone else tried to copy them.
Well, Jason, congratulations on everything you're doing. I really think Altruis has an exciting future ahead. I've said for a long time that I think a good independent custodian is needed in the marketplace. Certainly wish you all the best. Thank you very much for joining me this week.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, and best of luck and continued success with the show.
Thank you. That was Jason Wenk, founder and CEO of Altruis. All right, my last guest this week, certainly not least, is Tony DeFault, Managing Director at Pacific Global ETFs. They launched their first three ETFs last year. They've since added a fourth back in January, all focused on income generation in some capacity. And Pacific Global ETFs is under the Pacific Global Asset Management umbrella, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Pacific Life Insurance Company, who I think a lot of people are familiar with. Tony's on the line with me from Newport Beach, California. Tony, it's a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
You too, Nate. Thanks for having me.
So, Tony, first, I always love hearing the backstory on how and why new ETF issuers entered the market. And as I mentioned, I think most people are familiar with Pacific Life Insurance. So give us some background on the connection between Pacific Life and Pacific Global ETFs and sort of this decision to launch a suite of ETFs.
I would love to do that. Thanks for the question. There's actually a little bit more of the story on how Pacific Global Asset Management came about. And then when we looked through our inventory of needs, we quickly identified ETFs as an investment vehicle we need. But back in late 2017, we looked around and we had a lot of investment capabilities under the roof at Pacific Life. And for a company that founded PIMCO 30 years ago, there's a lot of learnings from that, and you really have to have your investment capabilities outside the roof of the insurance company in a standalone facility with its own leadership. So that's what we did in 2018. We created Pacific Global Asset Management, led by a gent named Kevin Byrne. And under that, we had fixed income team called Pacific Asset Management. They run corporate credit, floating rate loans. They just crossed $13 billion. We have a factor-based equity arm out of Boston called Cadence Capital Management. And we also have an internal private equity team, and they're at about $3 billion. So as we put these folks under one roof, we also looked at the product lines we have available. We had Pacific funds run by our annuities division, so that seemed like a natural fit to get it tied with our investment arm here. And then we also noticed we had some ETFs at different distributors, and honestly, they weren't being managed well and they were mispriced. So we made a decision to get all that under one roof and cleaned up. In particular, we started with a product called USDY. That's a U.S. dividend income product, and we repriced that at 29 basis points. And then our other one we just got that back in December was a floating rate loan product called FLRT. And we reduced that by 50 basis points to get it repriced at 68. So those were the two that got us in the door. long answer to your question. Forgive me.
Well, no. So tell us more about the ETF lineup itself. So you mentioned USDY. That's a U.S. equity income ETF. You mentioned the senior loan ETF, ticker FLRT. You also have a focused high yield ETF, ticker FJNK, which, by the way, that's a finalist for ETF.com's best new international or global fixed income ETF in 2019. So good luck on that. And then you also have an international version of USDY, the international equity income ETF, IDY. What is the overall idea with this lineup?
Yeah, you know, what's the strategy behind what we're doing and why should anyone care is how I like to explain it. When we noticed we had some ETFs that came through the adoption process, we had to have a compelling value statement to advisors. And just saying we showed up is clearly not good enough. But also, how are you going to differentiate? And when we talk to, again, advisors and different focus groups, if we came out with, like, products that didn't represent the heritage of Pacific Life, if we were too thematic or we had a lot of leveraged or options-traded funds, it really wouldn't reflect our core strength. So we said, what is our core strength? And we have a heritage and a DNA back to income. So our goal is to build income-oriented ETFs to help financial advisors. And personally, where that comes from on my side is, as I've spent so much time with that client base, I've seen just an enormous distaste for insurance products. And that hurts me to say that, because they do offer a lot of value. But the complexity and the hassle factor of issuing a contract to a client is really difficult. And if you look at how advisors have shifted to manage money, ETF is where you need to be. So with that mandate in mind, we're going to continue to roll out fixed income and other income-related ETFs actively managed. And that's an important distinction, because we really can't compete in the passive space. I think that war has already been fought, and there's no way we're going to get in there. But fixed income is really difficult to do in a passive way. And more to come on that front.
Well, can you talk more about the active management of these ETFs? And look, I feel like I keep saying the same thing every week on this podcast, but I'm going to do it again. I think the active versus passive debate is tired. I think every decision involved in investing is active. That said, if you look at the track record of active management, especially over the past 10 years, it hasn't really been great. I know fixed income has done better, but you know, overall, the performance hasn't always been there consistently. So what is the case for active management?
I agree with you 100%. What I'm talking about more is on the fixed income side. That's really hard to do and replicate, and especially hard to trade on the ETF side. So you do have to have a level of expertise. And when we looked at, can we do that? The answer is we have a long track record since 2007 and a longer track record with our heritage in PIMCO, understanding how fixed income works. And at this point, we haven't seen a lot of folks do a good job offering that in a passive strategy. At some point, that may be the case, but we see, and at least for the foreseeable future, a lot of opportunity and a unique way to differentiate there. On the active side, I'll concede that's a passive game at this point.
Okay, so looking ahead, again, obviously Pacific Life has a big brand name. I think investors know who you are. What do you see as your ETF strategy moving forward, just in terms of potentially more products coming to market?
I think there's two things. You know, having good product at the right price, it's important, but it's still in the commodity realm. There's a lot of other good players out there that can match what we do for sure. But when I study other really successful investment companies, it's their attention to detail with their client base advisors and helping them with their business. So you have to have product check, but two, how do you help that financial advisor with their business? So in the coming months, you'll see more from us on income engineering and income expertise to help advisors with their practice. That's how we plan to differentiate. We'll have more product that'll match that, but you really have to have that thought leadership differentiator where people trust you and you're offering unbiased advice, and that'll help them with that need.
Well, Tony, really appreciate your time this week. Certainly wish you all the success with the ETF lineup and look forward to connecting again down the road. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Nate. Thank you so much.
That was Tony DeFault, Managing Director, Pacific Global ETFs. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. If you enjoyed the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, I'll be joined by Alpha Architects' Wes Gray. Always fun when Wes is on the podcast. We're going to cover several topics, including their white label ETF business. We'll talk ETF portfolio construction and also a little ESG, which that'll tie in nicely because I'll also be joined by Connor Platt, who's president of Confluence Analytics, or an ESG data and research provider. Obviously a hot topic, so we'll discuss how they define ESG and how they compile their analytics. Until then, have a great week, everyone.